Hi, I'm Tess Viglund, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of September 24th, 2010. And today on the show, we are proud to present Act One of the Healthcare Reform Chronicles. Yeah, we're putting on a play because sometimes that's the only way to make sense of things. But we are also playing with our phones.
You touch the lightning bolt, it launches your camera. Once it gets a fix on the barcode, it takes a picture and comes back with information about that item.
We'll call that story Apps for Bargains. And been there, done that. This guy spent good money to listen to people talk over his favorite musical act.
It becomes an event that easily can swallow up hundreds of dollars. So please, on behalf of all concertgoers, consider a few basic rules.
We will hear those rules, but first, back to our production. A chunk of the new healthcare reform law took effect this week. It expands insurance for kids of all ages, and we'll get details on that in a moment. Other pieces of the legislation will come to fruition over the next 4 years. One element, which starts January 1st, requires that out of each dollar we pay in health premiums, 80 cents must be spent on actual healthcare. But apparently, what constitutes actual healthcare is up for debate. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner has been reading through some of the correspondence around that question.
It has been a long summer of letter writing for the insurance industry. 600 pages of letters, all of them starting like this.
Dear Mr. Felice.
Lou Felice chairs a group at the National Association of Insurance Commissioners.
Hello. I'm an actor playing Lou Felice.
Insurance companies want Lou to expand the definition of healthcare so that they can keep more profit. Everyone agrees that healthcare includes paying doctors and nurses, but what else? And so to illustrate where this back and forth between insurance companies and insurance commission chairman has led us, we bring you the last 6 months of written debate in about a radio minute.
Dear Mr. Felice, we are concerned that the current proposal does not include loss adjustment expenses.
Loss adjustment expenses. That's money they spend processing your claim. On that one, Lou Felice's group said,
No. Well, complying with the various requirements will require additional resources in terms of information technology and human resources.
Translation, salaries for insurance company lawyers and IT guys should also be considered healthcare.
Right, I'm going to have to go ahead and say no on that one. Tools that provide customers with information are important components of an overall healthcare strategy. Sending a letter to a customer does not qualify as healthcare. Yeah, I'm sorry, but what if we address you by name and mention your health problems in the letter? Right, well, that's a toughie. Okay, I'll allow it. And a nurse hotline? If you can prove it's working. And tracking down fraud? That sounds like healthcare.
And there you have it. Healthcare. Now including personalized letters, effective nurse hotlines, and fraud detection.
Hey, Lou, how about a break on taxes? Let me talk to the secretary and get back to you.
And that would be Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, whenever she decides to weigh in. We will let you know. But for now, Gregory Warner joins us with some non-thespian details. Hi, Gregory.
Hi, Tess.
So the new rules on what is healthcare, that's hardly the only pill that insurance companies had to swallow here. This was a milestone week for the healthcare law. Tell us a little bit about what happened.
That's right. So this week, the provision went into effect that you can keep your child on your health insurance policy until his or her 26th birthday. Mm-hmm. And that's up from age 19. Listeners might be familiar with these laws on the state level that have a lot of restrictions. Those are all gone. You know, so the situation where someone has to enroll in community college, now you don't have to be a student. You don't have to live in the same state as mom and dad. The only restriction is that you can't have insurance of your own.
So if I'm a parent of an under 26-year-old, what am I looking into in deciding whether to sign up for this?
Well, first you have to wait for your employer to offer it. Okay. And that's going to be when your plan renews. For some people, that's January 1st. Other people, it's June. Some point next year. Then it's up to your employer if they want to charge you more. And I talked to Joan Alker of the Georgetown Institute for Children and Families. She said that there are a lot of creative ways that companies can pass on those costs to workers.
They could start structuring their plans so that if you are picking up your family coverage, you have to pay more if you have three kids on your plan as opposed to two kids. And that would really focus the increased costs on the families who are using it.
But here's the good news. Professor Alker said that most companies don't plan to pass on the cost because, actually, for the most part, young adults are pretty cheap to insure.
What has been the insurance industry response?
This young adult provision is actually pretty good for the insurance industry. I mean, they do complain about it, but basically it means that millions of healthy young customers are coming onto the books. But other policies kicked in this week that they definitely don't like. For instance, lifetime dollar caps on coverage are abolished. So if you're very sick, you have an expensive-to-treat disease, you can stay on your plan indefinitely. Also, health plans have to guarantee coverage for children regardless of their medical condition.
So no pre-existing conditions for the kids anymore.
Exactly. No pre-existing conditions. Insurance companies say, well, this is a losing deal. You know, parents are going to run out and just buy those policies for their kids when they get sick. And so as of this week, in many states, some big insurance companies just stopped selling child-only policies. We're talking Aetna, Anthem, WellPoint, the big ones. So we saw a shift, really, this week. It was a door opened, but on the other side, some kids lost that access.
All right, and much more to come, of course, as we meet these deadlines for the healthcare reform package. Gregory Warner, thanks so much for your help today.
Thank you, Tess.
And special thanks to Alex Tora and David Sweeney of the Pig Iron Theater Company. You can find more on the new healthcare provisions at marketplace.org. Elizabeth Warren made her first official appearance this week as White House advisor to the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. She spoke about simplifying the home mortgage process at a Treasury Department forum. The Bureau has a lot on its plate, so we asked two consumer advocates to join us and give us their two cents on what the CFPB should tackle first. Travis Plunkett is with the Consumer Federation of America. Hello.
Hi there.
And Kathleen Day is with the Center for Responsible Lending. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Let me ask each of you first, and perhaps, Travis, you could take the lead here. Give me what you think is the number one objective that you would like to see this agency tackle immediately.
Perhaps the biggest objective will be to make the mortgage market safe for all participants, because we know that the mortgage problems spread to the housing market and then to the economy.
Mm-hmm.
But there are also serious problems for consumers with credit cards, with overdraft loans, private student loans. The list goes on and on.
And, you know, they actually got started on the mortgage issue this week. There was a panel put together by the Treasury Department, and it looks like their main objective there is going to be getting the paperwork down.
You mean the disclosures?
Right.
On the paperwork.
Right.
Right. And that is important, but as they cautioned, that's a first step, but it is by no means enough.
Kathleen, what would you like to see as the number one priority?
Well, there's so many to choose from,
right.
But two top ones would be making mortgage disclosure forms understandable. The other thing that's very, very important is to devise and make clear to the public how they can complain about what they think is an abusive practice, and making that public so that everyone else can see it as well.
Yeah, and it does seem like it's fairly complicated to figure out right now who you're supposed to write to, who you're supposed to complain to.
Right. So that has to be the first order, one of the first orders.
We should also mention that the confusing array of federal regulators, it's not only hard for consumers to know who to complain to, they largely have failed to satisfy many of the consumers who have complained. One office is infamous for not really providing any assistance to the consumers who are having problems with their banks. What they do is they forward the complaint to the bank that was the problem in the first place.
Yeah. You know, one of the other pet causes for Elizabeth Warren, who is now going to be tackling this agency, has been credit cards. And, you know, she was very instrumental in helping to persuade Congress to get the Credit Card Reform Act passed. But a lot of people are not satisfied with that. What are you thinking you'd like to see on the credit front? Travis?
The first thing would be to enforce the new Card Act. We've got some evidence now that some credit card companies are either evading the spirit of the law or actually violating the law, evading the letter of the law.
And would this bureau be able to do something about that?
Well, the bureau is going to have the ability to assess fines and also look at the books of the credit card companies. It'll have several tools at its disposal, so it certainly will, yeah.
And Kathleen Day of course, the Center for Responsible Lending. I assume credit is high on your list as well.
Yes, and I'd like to mention another abuse. The new credit card rules do not apply to small businesses. And so now we've heard of situations where companies, credit card companies, are sending individual consumers' credit cards that they're labeling small business cards.
Right.
And in that way, trying to make an end run around the rules.
Travis, what about student loans? That is probably the question that we get most often here on the show. How do I get help with my student loan debt? What can or should the Bureau do to help consumers on that front?
First, prohibit lenders from pushing students to take on more expensive and riskier private loans without first exhausting their federal aid.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a lot of predatory lending still by these proprietary schools. They're trade schools.
For-profit.
For-profit, and they often encourage, not always, but often encourage students to take on far more debt than they can pay off.
And for a degree that then really doesn't deliver what the for-profit school promised.
Hmm. You know, one criticism that we've talked about on the show before is that in the process of setting up all these increased protections for consumers, that there's the possibility that you could prevent very knowledgeable, very savvy people from investing the way that they see fit. They're aware of the risks. They're willing to take them. Can I get your thoughts on that argument?
People like me believe that some creditors have made credit far more complex than they need to the point where consumers, even very well-educated consumers, can't really understand what's going to happen. What we'd like to see is the agency saying, here are the products that are sort of standard, that are safe, and then if financial services providers want to offer trickier, more complex credit products, then the agency should say, the risk is higher here, so we're going to put some new requirements on you to make sure that you tell them about that risk, that you don't mislead them, and there's going to be more legal liability if you mess up.
Kathleen?
Well, let's not forget that every time anyone proposes some common sense rules in the lending industry, they trot out two scare tactics. One is credit will become scarcer and it will be fewer choices. These companies want customers, they want to lend, and they want to make money on it. The point of these rules is to make sure that it's not set with so many tricks and traps that the customer has no idea what's going on.
All right. Well, the Bureau certainly has its work cut out for it. We will check back with you perhaps in a few months and see how things are going. Travis Plunkett is with the Consumer Federation of America. Kathleen Day is with the Center for Responsible Lending. Thank you both for joining us.
Nice to be with you.
Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it's the time in the show when we take your money questions. Here to help us out this week is David Lazarus, personal finance columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome back, David.
Thank you.
You got a DJ name for me yet?
No, I haven't worked it out. But I saw that we got a lot of response when you and I were talking to DJ Sven, and we were talking about DJ names. One person actually wrote in to say, hey, it's really cool that David's trying to be hip on the air. And I'm thinking, trying to be hip? I mean, you're looking at a guy who can name both members of Wham. So
really?
Thank you. So wake me up before you go. That's all I got to say. Wow.
Hey, I wanted to ask you about a column that you did recently. Fascinating piece about counterfeit bills and how you as a regular consumer can really find yourself in a world of hurt, even if you have no idea you have these counterfeit bills.
Tess, when it comes to counterfeit money, the game is basically hot potato. And I got that from the Secret Service. Basically, what happened in this case was a guy goes to a credit union in Southern California, takes out $500 bills in cash to pay his rent, takes the money, gives it to the landlord. Landlord then goes to Chase Bank, deposit it. He says Chase Bank accepts all the bills, gives him a receipt, puts it in the drawer. Days later, he gets a notice saying, oh, we found out that one of the bills looked counterfeit. We're deducting it from your account.
One of the bills. So one $100 bill.
Just one. So the guy goes back to the branch. He says, wait a minute. How do I know what happened after I left the branch? What's the deal with this? And they said, well, we just didn't like the cut of its jib. And we took a closer look at it. Turned out that it was actually a $5 bill that had been monkeyed with to look like a $100 bill. That's a process called washing. It's relatively common. Huh. But the guy said, well, it went in the drawer. How do you even know it came from me? And Chase Bank insisted, well, the teller called a manager over before it went in the drawer, and we both determined it, and there it is, and you're out of luck.
Oh, wait, and so because it never went in the drawer, he's responsible?
Well, if it doesn't go in the drawer, in theory, they can trace it back to a specific customer because it was that person. But wait a minute, this isn't the rules of hot potato now. You're not allowed to throw the potato back. That's the thing. And so when I got involved in this case, and I actually had Chase pull the security tapes and say, all right, show me that they put it in the drawer.
Uh-huh.
And then they got back to me and said, oh, jeepers, the tapes are inconclusive, and so we're going to give the guy his money back.
Well, you say you talked to the Secret Service about this, and I guess my question would be even more basic. How are we supposed to know if we have a counterfeit bill or not?
And most civilians don't. Merchants all should be trained to do it, and that is holding up especially $100 bills to the light, seeing if they have been washed. But here's the other thing. If you go to a bank, you should be able to trust the bank to not give you funny money.
Yeah.
So in this case, the guy got a $100 bill from a credit union. What is the burden on a financial institution to inspect all money in advance before putting it into circulation? That's the first question. And then when another financial institution receives the money and actually takes it and lets you walk out the door, at that point, hot potato has now been completed. Any other merchant, if they got stuck with a counterfeit bill, they're going to eat it. So the idea that Chase had the temerity to throw it back, it was just one of those cases.
All right. Well, with that, let's go to the phones. And first up, we have Karen. She is in Cumberland, Maryland. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Where do you hear us there?
I hear you on 90.1 NPR.
Wonderful. And what do you do there in Baltimore?
I am a hairstylist.
So how long have you been doing hair?
25 years.
Wow.
That's a lot of follicles.
So is that like from Dorothy Hamill on, or am I going back before 25 years?
No, Dorothy Hamill on, yeah.
Nice, nice call.
Yeah, pulled that one out.
Very good.
I had that when I was about six.
I look good on everybody, too.
So do you work for a salon?
I do. Yeah. I work for a salon, and I have a small studio myself.
So what can we help you out with today, then?
Well, actually, my question was about my modification.
Mortgage modification?
I did a modification. I succeeded in doing a modification.
You did?
I did.
Oh,
I
think you're the one. Okay.
I'm the one.
Well done.
I think you're the first person we've talked to who actually got one.
I think if you send the papers enough times, they confuse themselves and they approve it.
There you go.
But no, I did succeed in getting a modification on our home mortgage, and I also succeeded in getting a modification on my home equity loan for a one-year term.
Oh, aren't you clever? Well done.
Yeah. Okay, so let's start with the home mortgage. Tell us what happened there.
Our home mortgage, we always paid on time, but I could see we were going downhill. Just with the economy, my husband's in construction, I'm in the beauty industry.
Were you underwater?
No.
Well, so then wouldn't that just be a refinance?
We didn't qualify because our income was too low.
Can I ask who her lender is?
Wells Fargo.
So in the case of your modification, were you trying to reduce the amount of principal owed? Were you trying to reduce the interest rate? What were you trying to do?
Well, we were trying to reduce the amount of the monthly payment. We had a three-month trial period. Now, our modification is 1 to 5 years is 3.875%, the 6 years is 4.8%, and from 7 years to 25 is 5.0%. So that's where we are with that. You know, it worked out well for us. Our mortgage payment is probably around $300 less now than what it was.
Because of the lower interest rate.
Exactly.
Okay.
My home equity modification was basically the same process, but it was a one-year term.
Is that also with Wells Fargo?
No, that was with a local PNC, Philadelphia National.
Okay.
PNC did not report us delinquent in any way. Wells Fargo did.
They did?
Yes. And that's basically my question. How should this modification, I know it's going to probably affect my credit score, but how should it be reported to the credit reporting agencies?
Now, you weren't delinquent under the new terms, correct?
We were never delinquent under any terms.
Okay, here's what you need to do. Mm-hmm. You need to sit down with Wells Fargo and say, look, I've done my end of this whole thing, and it seems as though somebody at your end has buggered this up somehow, and we need to straighten this out. It is Wells Fargo's obligation to make sure that your credit records are sound if you have not done anything to jeopardize them.
Okay. I did speak with a representative from Wells Fargo, and they told me at that time was not paid as agreed to the original, because the trial period, it was less than the original amount.
But you've got paperwork that says pay at this new rate, correct?
Absolutely, yes.
Then you are in the clear. You're a good scout, and Wells Fargo needs to stand up and fix this.
Okay, good. I wasn't sure if I should be thankful that PNC wasn't reporting, or if I should fight with Wells Fargo that it should not be reported. So,
however, I have heard stories that people who have gotten loan modifications have had it reported as a not paying as agreed, which you've probably seen on your credit reports.
That's what brought all this up. Yes, that's what Wells Fargo said when I called them.
Yeah, I have heard stories about that, and I don't know whether that is appropriate or not.
Well, that's
David,
just incorrect, though. Yeah. I mean, quite simply, if you're doing your end, then the lender needs to make sure that the credit reporting agency is up to date and correct.
Yeah, because you have a new contract with the bank.
Exactly, yeah.
I guess our suggestion would be, you know, first contact the credit bureaus, make sure you keep a paper trail, and then work with Wells Fargo and see if they can research this for you and find out what happened.
Okay, very good.
All right, good luck, Karen.
Okay,
thanks for the call.
Thank you for the information. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, next up we've got Michael, and he's in Washington, D.C. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
We're well, and you?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, what do you do there in our nation's capital?
I am a communications manager for a nonprofit. We work with other organizations to help them implement finances and management best practices.
Well, so working for a nonprofit is never a particularly lucrative
or profitable
or profitable way to go. But are your finances doing okay for you there in D.C.?
Yeah, I'm lucky. I'm doing pretty well. More or less, I'm able to save for retirement.
That's good.
But I do have a little credit card debt.
What do we mean by a little?
Couple thousand dollars.
Oh, okay, well, that's not too bad.
Is that it? Is that the extent of your debt overhang, or what?
I wish it were, but no. There's also some student loan debt as well, about $50,000.
Oh yes, we always feel that groaning in the background.
Yes.
So, are you looking for ways to consolidate, or?
Well, so the question is this: I'm wondering. I'm building up a savings, and I'm having some decent luck with that. But I'm wondering, at what rate should I be saving versus paying off the debt?
David, I think this is a fairly common question for people, trying to balance savings versus paying down debt.
And especially at times like these when somebody should have a little bit of a cushion, because
right.
You never know. Now, let me ask you this. What interest rate are you paying, and roughly what's your monthly debt service?
The student loan, the interest is about 5.5% or so, a few hundred bucks each month. I can handle it. I could handle it better if I weren't trying to save so much, though.
Aha. Uh-huh. How much are you putting aside?
I save a couple hundred bucks a month.
And how much do you have in savings then? Is that an emergency fund that you've got there?
It is. It's about $1,000 with a separate retirement account.
All right. Well, David, so he's got $1,000 in emergency savings, and he's got $50,000 in student loan debt. I personally would always advocate to have cash around. Your thoughts?
I think the key element here is that he's got a steady job.
Yep.
And unlike 14 or 15 million other people, that is a blessing. I agree right now at this point that with the student debt hanging out there, but with a relatively low interest rate mm-hmm. and relatively low monthly debt service, a few hundred bucks, it's all about that steady income. So as long as Michael can balance that out and doesn't feel like he's really sacrificing too much in the way of lifestyle, still put aside a little bit of money in savings and still pay down that debt on a regular basis, I would say don't throw a big amount of money at that at this point in your life. That'll come down the road. And as you move from the nonprofit world to the profit world, which will probably happen, as you watch that go up in life, then I think that's when you start being more aggressive about the debt.
That's good. Thank you. Thanks for your help, guys.
All right. Keep saving.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Next up, we've got Josh from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Josh.
Hey. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, it's our pleasure. How do you listen to the show there in Nashville?
I listen mainly on the podcast and on WPLN.
Wonderful. My producer has written up a note here that says that we could have used you a couple of weeks ago when we talked to Grace. She was a 14-year-old from Mankato, Minnesota, with dreams of becoming an astrophysicist. What subject do you like there?
I'm into science.
That's great. What do you want to do when you grow up, Grace?
I want to be an astrophysicist.
Whoa. Holy cow. All right. I love that.
It's someone that works with physics and space and black holes and quasars and all that.
Black holes and quasars and all that. Do you work on all that?
I actually don't work on that part of it. I actually work on discovering new planets and other solar systems.
Do you have, like, the biggest telescope ever?
I actually have a really, really small telescope. We actually are only looking for planets around bright stars for the kind of science that we do. But friends of mine actually work with really big telescopes, too, so we need all kinds.
Yeah. But I thought when you're hunting for new planets, it's all about the math, that you have to find, you know, these anomalies out there in space, and then you compute that it must be a planet passing in front of a star or something like that.
Yeah, that's actually what I do.
Wow.
I look for stars.
You sounded really smart there.
Thank you. Just for a moment. Yes.
Yeah, I actually look for stars that are being eclipsed by their own planets, and so it requires a lot of math and a lot of statistics.
Yet another reason why I'm not an astronomer.
Amen to that.
Thank you.
And how often do you find new planets?
We haven't found any yet. We're still in the finding stage, but there's about 400 planets known around other stars already, and there's more coming through all the time, so it's a whole new era of exploration.
Yes, but in Star Trek terms, are these M-class planets that the Federation can inhabit?
Not quite yet, but any day now.
Well, so how can we help you out today? If you're really good at math, why do you need us?
Well, here's the thing. My wife and I bought our house about 2 years ago with a 30-year mortgage. But lately I've been hearing how we can save money by refinancing. And we're going to be moving from our house in 2 years, no matter what, for job reasons. Hmm. And so if I balance the monthly savings against the closing costs, we break even after only 13 months. But this only works if we get one of those adjustable mortgages with big balloon payments. But they're fixed for 5 years. Is there any downside for getting a five-year fixed ARM?
Well, first of all, let's explain that an ARM, adjustable rate mortgage, it means you have a fixed rate for a certain number of years, as you've pointed out. And then after that, boom, it changes. And that's what got a lot of people in trouble during this economic crisis, David.
Absolutely. And a lot of the ARMs are pegged to different things. You know, you're facing an interesting situation, though. You're saying that, well, wait a minute, we're going to be out of the house more sooner than later, so doesn't this work in our favor? I would say that life is uncertain, and maybe I'm just financially conservative. You just don't know, quite honestly, how things go. And that's why I would say don't gamble, especially don't gamble with something like your house.
And it sounds like you're also really counting on being able to sell your house in 2 years. Are you confident that the housing market is going to come back that fast, that it's going to be easy?
Well, I mean, obviously, we would hope that we wouldn't take a huge loss. But, with the housing market the way it is, I would expect that, we'll just have to see what we can do. There's, we're not going to stay in Nashville just to have the house.
How do you know you're going to be moving? What's up?
Well, my position is it's a five-year postdoc, and I'll be finishing up then. And after that, I'll be looking for a permanent faculty job or another postdoc. You know, there's not a whole lot of astronomy jobs out there, so chances are we'll have to move to whatever city I can get the job in.
And you're pretty confident that you'll be able to get one?
I would hope so. I mean, it's a big gamble. You're right, but that's kind of the job we're in now. It's a competitive industry.
But I guess what I'm hearing, and maybe what David was getting at when he's talking about things can change, is that who knows 2 years from now if there will be a job for you. First of all, we certainly hope so, and you certainly have the degrees for it, and whether you'll be able to sell the house for an amount that you could stomach. There are just so many what ifs that when you do the math on this and you look at a balloon payment in 2 years, 5 years, it's a little risky, isn't it?
I guess so. I mean, I think the risk more is in just my job and my career. And so since that's already kind of where the risk is, taking the additional risk on the house is actually a pretty small one, because then that's a five-year time frame to work things out versus a two-year one for my job.
Mm-hmm. All right, but Josh, I can mitigate this whole thing, and that is you've got a fluky thing completely working in your favor, and that is we have historically low mortgage rates at the moment for fixed-rate loans, something like, 4-point-something percent. If I was you, I would go for a fixed rate loan and take away this element of chance that you're introducing into your life. If you're going to be refiing anyway, if you refi into a 15-year fixed rate loan at 4.4, 4.5%, whatever it's at right now, you're still coming out a winner.
Okay.
So what do you think?
I think that's a good idea, and I think I should go back and check on the rates for the fixed mortgages and run the numbers and see if it makes sense there.
Sounds good.
All right, but here's the deal. When you find that Class M planet, either Tess or I get naming rights.
All right.
Okay, I mean, that's the deal.
That's the deal.
All right.
All right, thank you guys very much.
Thanks so much for the call.
All right.
So, Tess, what will you name your planet?
I think I would name it after my mom. Oh, Julie. That... Planet Julie.
Planet Julie. That's so cute.
Isn't it?
But you can do that for a star right now. If you get a planet, you need to give it some, you know, a little bit of heft.
All right. What would you do?
I'd call my planet Steve.
Steve?
Steve. You know, and then when they invade other planets, we are from Steve. You know, impressive.
All right, folks. We want to hear what you would name your planet. Let us know. And then in the meantime, if you've got a money question, we will do our best to answer it. Give us a call at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or send us an email through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. David Lazarus of the Los Angeles Times, thanks so much. It's been fun.
And no more comments about me trying to be hip. Remember, I can name all the songs by Duran Duran.
And remember to ask your own financial professional before making any big money decisions. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. We are all familiar with the keeping up with the Joneses syndrome. Most of us are constantly comparing our lifestyles to those of our friends, our neighbors, our work colleagues. But how much do we really know about their income and spending habits? Not much. But thanks to the internet, there is a way to actually quantify the Joneses. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Jaidev Shergill used to work on Wall Street. A few years ago, he got a raise, but he barely noticed. By the end of each month, that extra money had vanished.
I was left with the same amount as I had the previous month, which was zero. I had basically just spent all the money and hadn't really upgraded my style of living at all. I hadn't really, you know, bought anything substantial.
He began to wonder about his friends. Did they fritter away cash like he did? How much did they save? He prodded, but didn't get far.
It's not a dinner subject. The conversations with friends around money are pretty much taboo.
All this got him thinking about a new business idea. He ended up creating Bundle.com. The website uses spending data to let people compare their spending habits to other shoppers, people in the same town and in the same age and income range.
Let's just click 50 to 75,000. And I've just typed in New York, New York. And when I hit update, it actually shows me the spending of other people like me with those same filters.
In March, New Yorkers in Shergill's demographic spent more than $1,000 on shopping. That seems pretty high to Bronx resident Sonia Pichardo.
Wow, the shopping is so big.
Pichardo is married with two little kids. She's interested in Shergill's vision for Bundle, that seeing how people like you spend money can help you curb your own excesses. When I first met her in the spring, she marveled that other Bronx families spent an average of $433 a month on groceries. She shops at Costco.
But you walk out, your shopping cart has $700 worth of food in it. And so $433 a month? No way. No way.
But that lower number stuck in her mind. Several months later, she has cut back at the supermarket.
I now spend about $450. I really reduced what was organic. I have a lot of mother guilt, and so I had to really get over it.
She may be saving on food, but she and her husband still spend far more than their peers on fixing up their home. Pichardo is showing me around with her 4-year-old daughter Eden in hot pursuit.
It's earring. Oh, you're back. Okay. So we've had a lot of work to do. So
the Pichardos live in a tiny 100-year-old brick house with a lot of character. The old staircase needs fixing. The house has no insulation, so the utility bills are high. And there's a gaping hole in the living room ceiling caused by water damage.
About 3 months before this happened, we were warned that this would happen.
Underneath, the water's coming in because they broke it.
Really?
The water was coming in, Mom.
In addition to their ongoing home improvement project, Pichardo says there are regular temptations.
Electronics is my, I have a problem.
She tends to splurge on new gadgets. She recently got a flat screen TV and a new MP3 player. Her friends buy this stuff after all. And that's the problem. Tom Mavis teaches marketing and consumer behavior at NYU's Stern School of Business. He says you can look at a website like Bundle and come away with good intentions to cut back, but our brains are wired to connect with people we actually know.
I look at my neighbor, and my neighbor just purchased a brand new car, and he's walking around with this Burberry coat, and has bought all these luxury items. Well, that's going to be much more vivid.
Even if you know your neighbor earns way more than you do, you'll still be tempted. Then there's the flip side of all this comparison. If you find you spend less than average, you might feel entitled to go on a shopping spree. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace Money.
Saving money is a no-brainer in the internet age. Go online, find promotional codes, coupons, special offers galore. And these days, you don't even have to be at your computer to get those deals. All you need is a smartphone and a dose of apophilia. Michelle Malte is a staff writer at the Los Angeles Times and a self-proclaimed apophiliac. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Okay, what is an apophiliac, and is there a medicine for that?
Well, the only cure for that is more apps. It's like more cowbell.
Which, by the way, is an app.
It is indeed. Apophilia is the desire and the need, the drive to just download and play with more apps. There are not enough apps in the day to cure that ill.
All right. Well, we're going to talk about some of the shopping apps that are out there. How can these save me a little cold, hard cash?
Well, number one, many of them are free and they can help you comparison shop and organize your life.
Well, give me an example of how one of these apps might help me out. So if I wanted to find that perfect pair of fall 2010 shoes.
First of all, you can look in the store and see if there's an app for that store. They may list their special offers in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then also one of my favorites is called Red Laser.
Red Laser.
It has changed the way I shop. If it has a barcode on it, you can zap it and you can find out what the prices are for any item, just about any item, and compare and decide whether you want to spend your money right there or go to another store or buy it online.
Well, how does that work then?
You open it up, you touch the lightning bolt, it launches your camera, and it gives you a field in which to focus on the barcode. Once it gets a fix on the barcode, it takes a picture and comes back with information about that item and the various prices for it.
Well, let me see if we have an example here. We've got some hand sanitizer here in the studio because all of the marketplace hosts have very dirty hands. And it does have a barcode on it. You want to give that a shot?
Let's give it a shot. We'll scan the barcode on our sanitizer here. It fixes on it, and it says instant hand sanitizer. Sometimes it'll come back with more information than that, but that's all we get for this one. It did identify the product.
So then if you're in the store, does it then also give you a price?
Well, it does have geolocation capabilities, so it can tell you what prices are locally and online.
So it seems like you don't really have to be very tech savvy to use a lot of these apps.
Well, this one in particular, you just need a steady hand.
Yeah.
To take the picture.
All right. Any other favorites?
Well, that technology is used in multiple apps. You'll find Red Laser scanning in the Shopper app, which is a little deeper than the Red Laser itself. You can create shopping lists, and it's available on both the iPhone and the BlackBerry.
Now, that sounds to me, I don't have that app, but that sounds to me like you could walk around your house, scan things that you want to then go buy at the store, and then you have a natural list?
Indeed. Ah. And you can also create a list on your desktop. So you don't need a smartphone to do this. And it can help you budget. So as you're making that list, if you know how much it is, if you're in the store, you can write down how much it is. It'll calculate the tax. If you have a coupon, you can include that.
Ooh.
And you can keep track of what you have on your list as well as what you have in your cart.
Honestly, this all sounds to me like it adds quite a bit of time and effort onto the shopping experience. I'm one of those people who I'm just going to go to the mall. I'm going to kind of walk through, see what's on discount, what's not.
Well, yes. The challenge is being organized takes time.
That is true.
There are some other cool apps that help you save money even as you spend.
Okay.
Coupon Sherpa.
So these are people who are helping you up the shopping mountain?
Indeed. This also offers geolocation. That'll help you in terms of figuring out where you are and whether there are deals there for you. A number of crowdsourcing apps are out. There's Groupon and Living Social. There are some that help you keep track of your loyalty discount cards. You're carrying less. Your phone's serving as sort of a mobile wallet.
Well, we will have a list of Michelle's top 10 shopping apps at marketplace.org. Michelle Malte is a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, where she regularly reviews iPhone apps. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
While we're on the subject of all the weird and wonderful ways technology can save you money, how about bidding for dental care? Or is that kind of like all-you-can-eat sushi, not something for which you want to take the cheap route? Vanessa Romo tells us about an online service that can chop the price of having healthy choppers.
Lately, my teeth have been feeling less than minty fresh. In fact, the last time I had my teeth cleaned or felt the stiff embrace of a dentist chair was over 2 years ago, the week before I was laid off and lost my dental insurance. Actually, lots of people are running around with furry teeth. A new poll by Gallup Healthways found that roughly one-third of Americans haven't been to the dentist in a year. But when a filling in one of my molars started crumbling, I didn't have much choice. So I went looking for a dental bargain on the internet. I landed at PriceDoc.com, a website that lets users bid on healthcare services, the same way you can bid on airline tickets. Think of it as the
Price Line Negotiator
of the healthcare industry. Of course, I had some doubts. Certainly bidding on an airline seat is no big deal. What's the worst that can happen? A middle seat, near the bathroom? But lowballing the person who will be wielding a drill in my mouth? The site does list every doctor's credentials, and there's a feedback forum where patients can write about their experiences, which, to be honest, is more research than I did when choosing my previous dentist. So I give it a try.
PriceDoc.com. Choose your service. Dental.
After culling through more than 100 dentists within a 10-mile radius, I zero in on one with glowing reviews, Dr. Tulai Kent. Her fee is $110, but I bid $70. My offer is rejected, but after two more attempts, Dr. Tulai Kent finally accepts a bid of $85.
I'm Tulai Kent. Welcome to our practice.
Dr. Kent can offer this big discount because I'm paying cash. No paperwork for her office or waiting around for a check from an insurance company.
That's what it feels like. Doing okay with it?
Mm-hmm.
The office was clean, she used modern equipment, a friendly staff, and the care I got didn't feel cut rate. But did I just get lucky? Linda Bloomberg is a health economist and senior fellow at the Urban Institute's Health Policy Center. She says you take a real risk when you go on sites like this. Her biggest concern is that
there's no information there in terms of discriminating quality. It's done with the information that the provider decided to put up.
Any doctor with a license can be listed for just $50. Beyond that, there's no screening method. Bloomberg also says if your mouth is really a mess, dental insurance might make more sense. But that's not necessarily true. It turns out most dental insurance policies only cover up to $1,000 a year, and that's after paying a few hundred dollars in annual fees. Even premium policies only pay for half the cost of fillings, root canals, or any type of oral surgery. So another option might be to negotiate a bundle price with a dentist, which is exactly what I found myself doing just a week after my visit to Dr. Kent. She found a bunch of other dental work I desperately need.
You already had root canal done. So for that reason, I sequenced this crown as a first thing. And then the second is a night guard. Once we do that, I recommend 3 fillings for you.
All in all, about $1,600 worth of work, which is way beyond my budget. Unless I start the bidding at $50. I'm Vanessa Romo for Marketplace Money.
Experts tell us that spending money on experiences will make us happier than if we spend it on things. Experiences, after all, create moments and memories that can last a lifetime. iPhones only last until, well, you know, the next version comes out. So take a vacation. Splurge on some concert tickets. But wait, about those tickets? New York Times columnist Ron Lieber has a few words for his fellow concert goers.
I was really looking forward to a lovely John Prine concert on Governor's Island in New York City a few weeks back. I couldn't wait to hear one of my favorite songs, Lake Marie. It was a perfect night with the Manhattan skyline in the background. But instead, I heard this. Okay, that's just a sound effect, but that's what it felt like. A show marred by bad fan behavior of all kinds. The talking, the singing. It was a veritable catalog of obnoxiousness. I know it's only rock and roll, but I don't like it, given how expensive tickets have gotten. Average prices are now about $60 for the biggest acts, up about 20% from 5 years ago, according to Pollstar. It's bad enough to have to pay a lot for tickets, but then you throw in childcare, food, and parking, and it becomes an event that easily can swallow up hundreds of dollars. So please, on behalf of all concertgoers, consider a few basic rules. First, don't talk. I mean, who are these dingbats who pay all this money to come to a show and talk over the music? Do you know what that sounds like? It sounds like this.
Oh my God, I love this song! I know, Rich. Do you think Debbie's trying to text us?
Yes, it's annoying. Brief questions about the song name or the time signature are fine, but keep it short and to the point. And if you don't care about your fellow concert goer, at least think about the musician up on the stage trying to perform over the chatter. And no, this rule is not suspended during opening acts, no matter how lousy. Also, don't stand. At shows with seats, here's the rule. If it's got a beat and you can dance to it, then you can stand up and dance. But if it's a ballad, then take a seat, okay? Now, famous ballads may inspire standing, swaying, hugging, or cuddling, which is acceptable. But please, limit this to 1 or 2 songs per show, would you? And finally, don't croon. No one from American Idol is here to discover you, and we did not come to listen to you sing. Unless you can sing on key and in harmony. Do I make the cut? We were standing. Standing by peaceful water. And if I don't, well, imagine paying big bucks to sit next to me at a concert as I warble in your ear. No fun, right? Because I can't be at every show to enforce these rules, I'm counting on all of you to take up this cause. The artists and the venues ought to weigh in too. Why not print your own rules on your tickets if you want to avoid arguments among your patrons? Yeah, it's probably not very rock and roll, but we fans would like it a whole lot more if we could just hear a little bit better.
Ron Lieber writes the Your Money column for the New York Times. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Oh, thank you for the applause. Next time, cutting your energy use is great for the planet, and of course, that's why people do it, right?
Who's not for saving money? You don't have to save the world. You're helping yourself.
Yeah, it's all about me. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We will see you next week. There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering long-term investment strategies built on experience, discipline, and research. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. This is Putnam Today.
American Public Media.